ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Nell Manow returns once again to help close out our June tribute to Rita Hayworth by looking at 1947's The Lady from Shanghai.
Your husband can take care of himself.
Nice night for it, ain't it, Mr. O'Hara? You didn't answer me, Mr. O'Hara. You ought to speak when you're spoken to. I'd hate to have to report you to the lady's husband. I said it's a nice night for it.
Hey, Mike, if you'll pardon me this intrusion, there's a couple of police officers out here.
Cops.
I don't speak their language, see? And they wants me to identify this guy. What's the Spanish for drunken bum?
Rita Hayworth's Elsa Bannister says you need more than luck in Shanghai at the beginning of Orson Welles' 1947 film, The Lady from Shanghai. You could say this about Orson Welles himself. The Lady from Shanghai was a film Welles wasn't ever really keen on doing. The Wunderkind Jack of all trades had seen his career almost end before it began, when his directorial debut, 1941's Citizen Kane, caught the ire of newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst. He followed that up with a presumed masterpiece, chopped to shreds by studio editors with the Magnificent Ambersons, and a South American set feature aborted and abandoned mid-shoot. Welles was a pariah in Hollywood by the mid-40s, but at least he had his wife, right? Welles was Rita Hayworth's second husband, the two married in 1943, but after Welles' ousting from Hollywood, their relationship was fraught, to say the least. Looking for work, Welles returned to the stage, working on a large-scale musical adaptation of Around the World in 80 Days, produced by Mike Todd. But, like most Welles ventures, the two ran out of money. Desperate to get their costumes back from the pawn shop, Welles put in a call to Columbia head Harry Cohn and gave him a pitch for The Angels. For $50,000, Welles offered to direct, star, and write a picture. He'd even throw in Hollywood's most alluring leading lady, his wife Hayworth, into the mix. Welles himself claimed he literally offered up the first book he saw, Sherwood King's If I Die Before I Wake, but it's more than likely that Columbia had the rights to King's novel and told Welles it would be the film that he'd work on. Regardless, Welles agreed, offering to work for free if Cohn helped bring the musical to fruition. With his hands tied, it's understandable that the finished feature, titled The Lady from Shanghai, wouldn't have Welles at his utmost attentive.
According to George here, Michael is anxious to quit.
Comes a change in weather.
Did you know about that, lover?
Comes no, I didn't.
Shut up, George. What's the matter, Michael? The hour's too long?
No, sir.
How about the money?
I don't care about that, sir.
So money doesn't interest you, Michael. Are you independently wealthy?
I'm independent.
Of money? Before you start that novel Elsa says you're going to write, you better learn something. You've been traveling around the world too much to find out anything about it.
That's good, Arthur.
Well, sir, I've always found it very sanitary to be broke.
It's said that once Welles got a chance to read King's novel, he felt it was horrible, but he started working on the script right away. Harry Cohn once offered the people in the screening room $1,000 to explain the plot to Lady from Shanghai, and it's appropriate because the film seems unnecessarily convoluted in its story of Irish immigrant Michael O'Hara and how he's pulled into murder and mayhem at the behest of the beautiful Elsa Bannister. Welles added numerous twists and turns to the script, rewriting well after production had already started. The original script apparently made more sense, taking time to introduce characters and extend the film's legendary Hall of Mirrors scene. But by the end, even Welles agreed that he didn't know what the plot was about due to all the stuff he'd packed in. Filming in San Francisco and Mexico allowed him to keep the studio away, but ending up shooting on a cramped yacht kept Welles from engaging in the camera trickery he'd made his debut with in Citizen Kane. It didn't help that there were practical considerations like crocodile-infested waters Rita Hayworth was swimming in, the heat was so brutal it actually killed an assistant cameraman, and Errol Flynn, who rented his yacht the Zaka to the production for $1,500 a day, would often disappear to corrals and generally engage in things we associate Errol Flynn with. Cast members, particularly Everett Sloan and Glenn Anders, couldn't stand Welles' domineering directing style to boot, but the entire project was filmed in just 35 days, with Welles uninterested in viewing the rushes, possibly a sign of how he felt about the film, as he was so desperate to get the feature away from him.
We'd put in at Fortaleza, but a few of us had lines out for a bit of idle fishing. It was me had the first strike. A shark it was. Then there was another. And another shark again. It was all about the sea was made of sharks, and more sharks still, and no water at all. My shark had torn himself from the hook, and the center, maybe the stain it was, and him bleeding his life away, drove the rest of them mad. Then the beasts took to eating each other. In their frenzy, they ate at themselves.
The Lady from Shanghai could itself be seen as an act of sabotage from a man who hated being a director for hire. But where Welles was revered long after the film, The Lady from Shanghai ended up ruining the career of actress Rita Hayworth. Ida Lupino was the first choice for the role of Elsa Bannister, but Welles wanted French actress Barbara Lage. It was Cohn who demanded Hayworth star, knowing her contract would be ending soon and she'd eventually strike out on her own, where she was actually able to make her own money through her production company. There are many theories on why Hayworth wanted the role, short of being told to do it. It's alleged that she hoped playing Elsa would strip away her love goddess image, or that because Welles had told her to take the role, it could have fostered a reconciliation between the two. Before production started, Welles told Hayworth she needed to cut and dye her hair from its long red to a short platinum blonde bob. When Harry Cohn saw his Gilda rocking the new haircut, he lost it, saying, quote, "The six people who saw what Orson Welles did to Rita wanted to kill him, but they had to get behind me in line." The haircut incited a media frenzy, with Luella Parsons, who already didn't like Welles since his Citizen Kane days, alleging that he'd intentionally torpedoed his wife's career. Audiences were so upset, they wrote into the studio asking for locks of Hayworth's hair in order to preserve it.
"I couldn't think where else we could meet. Only tourists come here and school children."
"And lovers?"
"Oh, Michael.
Fair Rosalie.
You love me very much.
I do.
Do you still want to take me away with you?"
"Why do you ask me that?"
"Tell me where we'll go, Michael. Will you carry me off with you into the sunrise?"
"Stop tormenting me. I'll take proper care of you. You won't stir."
"I don't care where it is, Michael. Just take me there. Take me quick. Take me."
Like most of Welles' films, the original rough cut of Lady from Shanghai clocked in at 155 minutes, but a disastrous test screening forced the film to go back to studio editors, who cropped out over an hour of footage, leaving it at a very lean 87 minutes, ruining many of Welles' elaborate stage setups and aiding audiences' confusion. The film finished shooting in 1946, but the studio held it back for 2 years, so when it did finally see theater screens in 1948, Columbia refused to promote it, sticking it as the bottom feature on double bills. It received respectable reviews, despite how often critics brought up that the plot was incredibly confusing, but they cited Welles' set pieces and Hayworth's unique performance. Unfortunately, the movie made little money in theaters, and it was the last time the studio offered a director carte blanche to write, direct, and star. Harry Cohn infamously said it was often more trouble than it was worth because no one could be fired, considering the director, the writer, and the star are one and the same. Welles struggled to find his footing after the disappointment of The Lady from Shanghai, but it was Hayworth who bore the brunt of the shame. Her marriage ended with Welles 7 months after shooting wrapped. Hayworth would go on to marry 3 more times, none of them succeeding. Hayworth eventually became a princess, marrying Prince Ali Khan in 1949 and had 2 daughters. She remained an enigmatic presence in films, but she never soared to the heights quite like she did in the early 1940s. Rita Hayworth passed away from Alzheimer's in 1987. When we come back, Nell Manow joins me as we try to figure out what is the plot of The Lady from Shanghai.
"I knew I'd find you two together. If I hadn't, Elsa, I might have gone on playing it your way. You didn't know that, but you did plan for me to follow you."
"You've been drinking."
"I presume you think that if you murder me here, your sailor friend will get the blame and you'll be free to spend my money. Well, dear, you aren't the only one who wants me to die. Our good friend, the district attorney, is just itching to open a letter that I left with him. The letter tells all about you, lover.
So you'd be foolish to fire that gun. These mirrors, it's difficult to tell. You are aiming at me, aren't you?
We are doing our second tribute to actress Rita Hayworth. We are talking about 1947's The Lady from Shanghai, otherwise known as the movie that we're going to try to figure out what it's actually about. Once again, I am joined by the lovely Nell Manow. Nell, how are you?
I am just fine. I'm looking forward to having you explain to me what The Lady from Shanghai is about.
We talked about Gilda last episode, which is pretty straightforward. It's a pretty straightforward noir. The Lady from Shanghai, I almost think, is confusing for a multitude of reasons. I think it's confusing for the sake of being confusing. Directed, uncredited by Orson Welles, written by him, starring him. I'm pretty sure he gave costumes and craft services and all of that. Also stars Rita Hayworth, Orson Welles' wife at the time. Well, wife when they filmed this, ex-wife by the time this movie actually came out, as well as Everett Sloan. And we're going to talk about the plot. We're going to try to figure out what it means. I want to say I saw this before I saw Gilda. I really enjoyed it. And it wasn't until the second time I watched it, this is, I think, the third time I've watched it all the way through, that I realized this movie makes very little sense. And this movie has some big flaws. But I still really applaud what Welles did. I'm not big on Orson Welles, his career, as I probably should be. I just saw Citizen Kane for the first time last year. But when he was working in Hollywood, his movies have a very disjointed quality to them. I don't know if that's your experience. What's your background with this movie?
I actually came to this movie fairly late. I, of course, was aware of the one thing that everybody's aware of about the movie, which is that classic shootout in the Hall of Mirrors. And it was only after I saw Manhattan Murder Mystery, which does kind of their own version of that scene, that I was prompted to watch it. So I really only saw it when I was already well versed in Rita Hayworth and in Orson Welles. Really, I think that is the most memorable part of the movie. Probably the story behind the movie is more interesting than the story of the movie.
This is one of those movies where you get a lot of questions about what was left on the cutting room floor. This movie was originally supposed to be 155 minutes. It was cut to 92. IMDb with the runtime is less than 90 minutes. They listed as an hour and 27. I always envisioned this movie being longer. Even when I rewatched it today, I thought, God, this movie feels really short. And that leads to a lot of questions about what the plot is. Now, Orson Welles only offered to make this movie. He called Harry Cohn. They were supposed to be making the Mercury Theater, which was Orson Welles' theater troupe, was doing a musical of Around the World in 80 Days, and they'd run out of money. So he called Harry Cohn and offered to write, produce, direct, star in the first book that he picked up, which was the book that this movie is based on, which I can't remember the name of it right now. It's written by Sherwood King. It's not called The Lady from Shanghai. But he literally picked this book up, offered to make this movie if Harry Cohn would wire them $5,000 to keep this play going. And he did.
Get his costumes out of hock.
Yes.
I mean, literally, they had taken away the costumes. So he was really in trouble. And I think Orson Welles, who, of course, was not known for being shy or having a lack of confidence, he figured he could take the phone book and make it into a good movie, or that he didn't care. And I think that's really the problem with this movie. He really, you could tell, he was sort of biding his time. He didn't take much of it seriously. It was something that he had to do to get to do something that he wanted to do. It is a mess. And I want to start with the thing that I think is probably the most annoying thing to me in the movie, and that is Orson Welles himself, his performance, and his truly, truly terrible Irish accent.
Oh, the accent. I was literally just talking to somebody the other day about bad Irish accents. And I had a couple of people listed, and I really forgot Orson Welles. His accent is not quite Lucky Charms Leprechaun.
But it certainly calls that to mind. Well, for one thing, it comes and goes within
yes.
the same sentence.
One minute he'll be talking in this brogue, and then the next he just sounds like Orson Welles.
It's just terrible. It's really one of the worst accents in the history of movies. And it distracts you from the movie because you're just, I'm sorry, where is he? Did he all of a sudden become Serbo-Croatian or something?
Well, I think there's a lot of laughter at his expense because they make a big deal about, oh, he's Black Irish Michael O'Hara. And you're like, he's Orson Welles, okay? I'm not buying that he's Irish in any way, shape, or form. You bring up a good point. Is this a vanity project, or is this him being completely apathetic? Because I think at times, it's both and it's none. The thing that annoys me about this movie, accent aside, is how much of this feels like Orson Welles trying to pat himself on the back. I hate the narration in this movie. It comes and goes. It's like monologuing. It takes over everything. And if you have to explain your thought process, then you're doing a really bad job as a writer. You have to hear him in this horrible accent talk about these, and they're not even really noir platitudes. It's not Fred McMurray doing the narration in Double Indemnity talking about why does death smell like honeysuckle and stuff like that. It's just this really overwrought, almost tediously meaningless monologues about, you know, oh, stupid fool was I. He sounds like Pirates of the Caribbean almost. That does feel like it's Orson Welles, like you said, doing what he thinks people want, which is talking about himself, and it really doesn't work here.
Yeah, it's terrible. And I have to just give a footnote here because very unexpectedly, one of my favorite people in the history of Hollywood movies, of old Hollywood movies, shows up in the behind the scenes because the man who had the rights to this novel, which no one remembers the name of, was none other than William Castle, who is better known for completely batty, cheapo horror movies with extremely inventive advertising campaigns that were much, much more creative than the films themselves. So 13 Ghosts, Homicidal, The Tingler, all of those, the fabulous documentary about William Castle, definitely worth seeing, as are his films. But he was the one who that, for example, in his movie Homicidal, he had the coward's corner where
right. The
movie would say, she's going to go into the house. If it's going to be too scary for you, you got 15 seconds to go get your money back. And you had to go to the coward's corner to get your money back. And, you know, or they'll take out $1 million life insurance policy if you die of shock watching the movie.
He also did House on Haunted Hill. Right.
Yes. Yes. And he also did Rosemary's Baby and even has a very, very, very brief cameo.
That's right.
So I love William Castle. He's sort of a modern day P.T. Barnum. And I love that he all of a sudden, you know, gets mixed up in this because Orson Welles randomly picks up a book and turns out that Castle had already purchased the rights.
Orson Welles and William Castle have a lot of commonalities, I think, in terms of both of them having these unique visions, both of them having these very ingrained personas.
Definitely. And both of them were bombastic showmen. Both
right.
of them were magicians in a way. I definitely see a connection there. One of the problems is that for most of the movie, Orson Welles really did not care what was happening.
Yeah.
He was just waiting to get to the parts that he was interested in. And of course, his relationship with Rita Hayworth, both on and off screen, is really nuts.
Harry Cohn offered $1,000 to whoever could explain the plot to this movie for him because he did not understand it. He originally wanted to have this trial scene at the beginning of the movie and have the movie play out in flashback, but the movie was so over budget, he was so sick of dealing with Orson Welles that he didn't want to shoot anymore. So he just said to release it as is. This was actually held over for a year, filmed in 46, released in 47. Trying to explain the plot is as follows. This is the best iteration of the plot that I can give you. Orson Welles is hired by Everett Sloan's character, Arthur Bannister. Elsa,
who we remember from Citizen Kane, of course.
Right.
And Orson Welles plays a sailor.
Yes, who catches the eye of Arthur's wife, Elsa, played by Rita Hayworth. We're not totally clear on if Elsa is just a honeypot meant to lure Michael to Arthur, a la Johnny Farrell and Balin Munson in Gilda. That part is intentionally vague, but regardless, he is hired. He is brought on the boat, which is Errol Flynn's boat, Zaka. Errol Flynn's dog is in the movie. Errol Flynn is in the movie if you really know where to look. They're sailing. Bannister's business partner, Grigsby, played by Glenn Anders, wants O'Hara to kill him, or at least fake a killing, so that Grisby can get away with some type of insurance policy. But it's pretty obvious that Grisby really just wants some sort of deniability so that he can kill Bannister. Grisby ends up dead, and it ends up being put on O'Hara because he wrote the stupid little confession. And then you find out that Grisby and Elsa were in it together to murder Arthur, but then she didn't like Grisby. It is the most convoluted love triangle. What it really boils down to is Elsa just wants her freedom. And that's the best synopsis.
I just want to say, I'm a lawyer, and I've done criminal law, and the whole premise of this fake murder offer is that if there's no body, he can't be prosecuted. That's actually not true. So for those of you out there who are thinking that you've got some great plan, that's not true.
I was sitting there thinking, this is Law and Order SVU bad. This makes no sense whatsoever. I was like, even in the 40s, I'm still sure you needed a body. And I'm pretty sure a written confession saying, I totally flat out murdered this guy. This is how I did it. And I have witnesses. It's still going to convict you.
Yeah, that would be enough to convict you in any country in the world. So, I mean, that just shows you how little they really cared. Baseline for stupid movie twists is, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and he's about to get married to somebody else, and his friends persuade him that because he doesn't have cuffs on his trousers, he'll embarrass her. So, of course, he leaves her at the altar going out to look for cuffs on his trousers. Or another Rita Hayworth movie where Fred Astaire wants to marry Rita Hayworth, and she says no. So they're in a play together, and he has a real preacher stand in for the actor playing the preacher.
Oh, yeah. I love that plot device.
Yeah. I mean, it's about that level of accuracy.
You bring up Orson Welles as a magician. It really layers on these twists in the hopes that you will be distracted and so confused by what's happening that you won't notice that it's really crappily written. And Orson Welles was writing the script daily on set while they were filming because even he didn't know what was going on. It's a very rapid-fire film. I mean, if you don't really have time to get bogged down in plot, but when you really think of it, once you get Michael on the boat, and Michael, from the entire beginning of this movie to the end, has been saying, I'm going to quit. I'm not working here anymore. And he's the main character of Clerks. Like, I'm not even supposed to be here today, but he never leaves.
But in true noir fashion, what keeps him there?
Oh, exactly, is Rita Hayworth. He has, again, monologues about destiny and following his nature and everything. Once they get to the Grisby murder plot, and we got to talk about how silly some of these plot devices are. The Glenn Anders character is the apotheosis of silly in this movie. But when he starts talking about wanting to be murdered, you really lose the core of the movie, which is the Elsa-Arthur-Michael love triangle. As much as we're going back and forth about whether this is a vanity project or not, I also think this movie doesn't know if it wants to be Gilda or not, because there are so many commonalities to Gilda in this movie. There's even a scene where they play Amado Mio, which is the song from Gilda. There's a scene where Rita's going through, I think it's a restaurant or something, and they play the song. It's almost like Orson watched Gilda and said, I'm going to do the opposite of that. So Gilda is this poor young girl who's driven into abusive relationships. Well, we're going to make her evil and have her be the one who's really pulling all the strings. Gilda had really long red hair. We're going to chop it all off and bleach it blonde. But at the same time, you could have had something with that. You could have had something by making Rita Hayworth this maniacal villainess. But really, she just seems to stumble into it the way it's written.
I hate to sort of go off Felicity on her, but losing the hair really did make a big difference.
It's Samson. It's like, it's biblical almost. It's like a Samson-esque loss of power.
Yeah, it is. She looks uncomfortable and unhappy. I don't know if that's because of what was going on off screen or because she cared about the fact that it didn't make any sense. You can take a movie like Casablanca, where Ingrid Bergman, because they were writing the script one day at a time, did not know as she was filming which guy she was going to end up with. And that actually helped her performance because that confusion and that sort of better play it both ways really worked very well for the performance. In this one, I think she genuinely did not know. Am I a good person? Am I a bad person? And I said to you when we talked in the last episode, I'm not trying to diss her by saying she's really not an actress. She's got an incredible screen charisma. She's a thoughtful person, but she doesn't have a huge range. Give her something like this where you really do not know where your character is going or what she's supposed to be. She was a bit at a loss. She didn't even have the advantage of being blank slate in this. She just seemed like she didn't know what she was doing.
They said at a certain point that the editor actually got mad that Rita Hayworth had no close-ups in this movie. They actually forced Orson Welles to film some. That really leaves you to question whether he just really wasn't interested in having a star overshadow him. That's really what I take away, is that Orson knew that people wanted to see her, and he really wanted to mitigate that by making her as unnecessary as he could without, while still making her be a vital component. Losing that hair, she looks just like any other femme fatale. You could have literally had anybody play this role. It could have been Claire Trevor. It could have been right. Barbara Stanwyck. And that's a real loss, to take away your actress's, I don't want to say one distinctive quality, but the thing that people had identified her with.
As we talked about before with Gilda, she used the hair very, very effectively. That was one of the ways that she showed what was going on with her, that she showed emotion. And Welles decided not to use close-ups. He said it was a stylistic choice. But the fact is, close-ups have been very important in movies going back to the silent era. That's one of the ways that we relate to the screen, and people expect that, and they especially expect it with a glamorous star like Rita Hayworth. And so it does keep us remote from the story. Orson Welles had the following priorities. Number one priority, get the money for the costume so he could put on his production of Around the World in 80 Days. Number two priority, get the thing done as quickly and simply as possible. Number three, visit the locations. The reason that there are so many different locations in the movie is that those are all places he felt like going. And number four, do the mirror scene. That was the only thing that really interested him. Because even the performances in the movie are, generally speaking, are not that good. I thought Everett Sloan was absolutely great, but I thought Glenn Anders was terrible.
There's some really weird decisions that are made here. I do want to go back to Hayworth real quick before we talk about the character actors. Harry Cohn took it out on Hayworth because he felt that Orson Welles had ruined her by chopping off all her hair. And you bring up that a lot of the relationships in this movie, you take away a lot of Rita Hayworth's vitality, too, in this movie. She barely cracks a smile in this film. And I think you really lose something by having an actress who was known for being this ball of sunshine, even in a noir, and having her be this sad, cynical type of character. I don't think she knew how to do that, because she hadn't been tasked with doing that.
I totally agree with you. The one thing, she has this incredible vitality. You see that in all of her roles, whether she's playing the sweet girl next door in Cover Girl, or whether she's playing the girl gone wrong a little bit in Gilda. She had this unbelievably wonderful vitality. And you see toward the end of her career, when she was older and she was faded a little bit, and that worked well for her in some roles. But at this stage of her career, if she didn't have that, she didn't have anything. Whether we think of her as somebody who was complicit in this weird quadruple cross, or whether we think of her as someone who somehow got herself married to this guy and was not sure how to get out of it and really was interested in a life with a sailor, but not if he was going to be poor, whatever interpretation you bring to it, there's no basis for it in her performance.
No, it also leads to my big issue, which is, look at her relationship with Johnny in that film. Look at her relationship with Welles in this, and they were married, too. So you think that there would be some sort of spark between the two of them. Yeah, there's no chemistry between the two of them. There's an opening scene where he literally meets her on the street, and he thinks, like, hey, this chick is hot. He pursues her, and that's it. They're only real moments alone together outside of the Steinhardt Aquarium moment. But that's their introduction, their meet-cute, so to speak. And I really don't feel that there's any connection between the two of them. He just seems standoffish and better than them. He sits in the corners in a lot of their scenes. It's interesting looking at composition. She's lined up alongside Arthur and Grisby in many scenes with O'Hara on the other side judging them. But that leads to the end, which you don't buy when she's trying to, like, pretend that she's into him, you know, oh, it was always going to be you and I running away together. You never really buy that because there's been no foundation for this relationship.
No, there's no spark between them whatsoever. We talked about in the earlier episode about how in Gilda she's with Glenn Ford, with whom she made more movies than anybody else, and they had a wonderful kind of smoldering thing happening between them. But as we well know, because we've seen it over and over again, actors who have a real life relationship don't always translate that way to screen. And that's too bad. That's just movie magic. People sometimes who don't even like each other. I mean, there's never been a better couple on screen ever than William Powell and Myrna Loy, and they certainly were friends, but they were never romantically involved. There's some interesting choices. He's supposed to be very dark, very black. He's this black Irishman. She's very white with that blonde hair, and maybe there's some concept behind that. But in reality, when they're talking to each other and she says, yes, I want to go away with you, but we're going to need some money, I never bought that.
Yeah, he has more chemistry with Joan Fontaine and Jane Eyre, I think, than he does in this movie.
And he has a better accent, too.
Exactly, yeah. You know what? Just go watch Jane Eyre sometime. Well, watch both. I recommend this. You brought up the side characters. I had not noticed how weirdly macabre the humor is in this movie. There are some very bizarre, grandiose, grand guignol decisions made with these characters. You have Arthur, the Everett Sloan character, who I have issues with because he's the evil disabled guy, but his constant repetition of calling Rita's Elsa lover to kind of irritate her. And then you have Glenn Anders as Grisby, who is just like Bugs Bunny the entire movie. The target.
I thought he was from another movie.
Yes.
He was really, not that everybody else was doing a great job of acting, but I thought his acting style was completely inconsistent, and the suits he was wearing were completely inconsistent with the rest of the movie.
He sounds like a cartoon character. He gets more close-ups, I noticed, than Rita Hayworth does in this movie. The camera's always in his face. And it culminates with the courtroom scene where there's just this layering of characters. Wells goes a little off the rails of trying to show this madness, that these wealthy characters are mad. He brings up the sharks eating each other. He has this grand monologue about the sharks smelling blood in the water, and then they all turn on each other. And George and Arthur have this really weird, not quite homoerotic relationship, like a Balin Munson or a Johnny Farrell in Gilda, but they do have this kind of symbiotic two halves of this crooked whole. But I don't know if that necessarily works. It reminded me a lot of Spellbound with the Dali scenes that are just so over the top, and you feel like I'm being inundated with these weird things for the sake of weirdness. He talked about wanting to reference Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I wasn't sure if he wanted to make this grand expressionistic metaphor or this straightforward noir. And it's a weird hodgepodge of both.
You really can't tell whether they are trying to tell you a story or making fun of that overwrought storytelling.
When you have such grand moments like this, you also notice the little itty-bitty problems. I noticed a lot this time how much overdubbing happens. Orson Welles had talked about wanting to have certain dialogue be really low, and then they didn't do that. The editor actually went in and fixed that. But you can really see the ADR, the recording that they do. Orson Welles' mouth is not moving, and dialogue is coming out of his mouth, and you can see it. Welles' stunt double is incredibly obvious.
It's not the same build.
Oh, no. You can also see when they speed up the camera to make it look like Orson's moving quicker. I mean, he's just not. And those things really bothered me because I knew they weren't part of the grand macabre humor. Those are just things that they were doing to cover up flaws in the filmmaking. And so, again, you have this really weird juxtaposition of questionable filmmaking techniques and then supposedly deliberate filmmaking.
Well, I was thinking when I watched it this most recent time a little bit about Beat the Devil, because that's another movie where nobody could figure out for a long time whether they were serious or whether they were mocking. And another film where a very well-known kind of iconic star all of a sudden turned up as blonde and freaked everybody out.
I haven't seen that one. It's still on my list. I have to get to it. I do want to bring up the locations. There's a lot of interesting locations here. I love the Steinhardt Aquarium scene. They're in San Francisco. They're in the Steinhardt Aquarium. They filmed on location. Orson Welles actually ended up doing a lot of matte usage of the fish to make them look like they're being attacked by sea creatures. Very confused right. on what the tone is there. I've been to the old Steinhardt Aquarium before they raised it and rebuilt it in San Francisco, and I used to love that place so much. It wasn't ADA accessible, but it was beautiful. So every time I watch that, I get very nostalgic because it's the last real glimpse you get of what it looked like before. But it is a moment that tries to be a throwback to noir. It's the moment where Rita Hayworth's character throws herself at Michael, that whole take me line, and the children show up and they start giggling. And I do think it's effective. But I almost wonder, like you said, why film it at the aquarium? She brings up that only children and tourists show up here, but still, it just seems like they like the location.
Well, sure. Why film it at a Chinese restaurant and a House of Mirrors? The locations, in terms of the geographic locations and the settings, were much more important than the story to him. Because they were almost like puzzles. And again, he really is a magician. Did you ever see his documentary, F for Fake?
I have not.
Okay, well, I super recommend that. But it's about a lot of stuff, but it's also about a massive fraud. He just was constantly fascinated with sleight of hand, with magic, with con men. As a filmmaker, those little puzzles, the idea of shooting in the aquarium, shooting in the Hall of Mirrors, those fascinated him much more than, say, telling the story or the characters.
We got to talk about the ending in the fun house.
Yeah.
Which is a great, great scene that was supposed to be longer. They cut it down significantly. It's one of those moments where everything Wells is trying to say comes together. The multiple mirrors, the duplicity of people, him falling down the slide, which is oddly cathartic and fun to watch, even though I don't think it's Wells that actually is going down that. I think it might be a stunt double. And all of it is there to blind you to the fact that what I noticed this time around is Hayworth's death scene is really, really good because it's stripping away all the glamour and all the beauty, you know, and she's just this woman crying about how she doesn't want to die alone. And the movie ends up letting that scene down because you're just so flummoxed by, how did we end up here?
This is what you've been waiting for the whole movie. Anybody that knows anything about movies knows that this is coming. And it really is just a stunningly, beautifully realized scene. When you see Everett Sloan's enter the visual of the mirror, when you see that his canes all of a sudden appear, when you see the splintered images of these characters and they're shooting and you don't know, are you shooting the image or are you shooting the real one? Really, it is one of the most bravura, beautifully done, beautifully directed scenes ever. Finally, the real tone that the movie's been struggling to achieve all the way through.
Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we close things out?
I agree with you that it's definitely worth seeing. Don't spend too much time trying to figure out what the plot is, because they didn't, so why should you? Rita Hayworth, even with the fact that it's not her best performance, is always interesting to watch, always fascinating, and it's worth it to sit through it just to get to the ending.
Yeah, we didn't talk about Rita Hayworth's later career. She got divorced after this, took some time off to raise her children. She ended up getting married again to Prince Ali Khan, became the first princess actress, in case you thought Grace Kelly was the first. And really, by the time she came back to film in the 50s, kind of Hollywood had changed. She wasn't able to play the same type of characters. It's a shame. I don't want to blame this movie as ruining her career, but I definitely think it played a hand. And Rita Hayworth is just the best part of this movie. I do recommend Lady from Shanghai. It's confusing. It's macabre. It's weird. But that's part of the charm. In terms of what Orson Welles directed, this is probably one of his biggest Hollywood efforts. It's not filled with Mercury players. He had to stay within the lines as best he could, and you can feel and see him rebelling against that. Just as a piece of, like, weird whimsy, it's worth watching, and it's very quick.
It's over fast. And I would say also it is definitely worth seeing Miss Sadie Thompson for her later career, and The Story on Page One is another one that's very good. But the two that I would say everybody should see are Pal Joey, not my favorite movie, but she is wonderful in it, and that's her last musical, and that striptease number that she does is terrific. Also, Separate Tables. That is a movie where it's an ensemble cast. She doesn't have to carry the whole film, I guess I would say that I think it's her most subtle performance, her most naturalistic performance, and definitely worth seeing.
Can't say I've seen any of her films after this, which I need to, because I've liked everything I've seen of her before, and even the movie she made the same year as this, Down to Earth, which is essentially what they remade as Xanadu in the 80s. I really enjoy
it. Silly movie.
Oh, Xanadu is so much fun. I will make that a Patreon goal one day. One day I will do an episode on Xanadu and talk about how much I love it.
Oh, we'll have to get my husband on, because he loves that movie.
He is invited. He is invited to wax rhapsodic with me about Xanadu. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah.
This is the limitation of, I think, any actor. Every actor hits a wall. And this is the limitations of her acting ability in this movie. But it's still good. She's very underrated in this film, even though it makes not a lick of sense.
Scene by scene basis, nobody knew what they were doing in this movie. But just every time she's on screen, you can't take your eyes off of her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Come for the Rita Hayworth, stay for the Orson Welles accent. There you go. Well, listeners, you can send me your thoughts on The Lady from Shanghai, Rita Hayworth, anything you want to talk about, you can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Once again, I'd like to thank Nell Manal for joining me all month to talk about Rita Hayworth. Nell, where can fans find and get in touch with you, see your work, all of that?
Well, first of all, it is a pleasure, as always, to be on the podcast. I hope to come back on again very soon. And people can find me at moviemom.com and at moviemom@moviemom.com if you want to write to me.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. And as always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider going the extra mile and supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast that it is. Right now, patrons can hear my interview with Michael Curtiz biographer Alan K. Rohde, my interview with Sarah Louise Lilly, who is a TCM On Location's tour guide, and becoming a patron just got more beneficial, as I'll be releasing two monthly supplemental podcasts. One is an untitled podcast looking at various films, and there's sometimes multiple movie remakes with co-host Adam Kautzer. The other, entitled Based on a True Podcast, will see William Bibbiani and I discuss your favorite old Hollywood crime dramas and biopics through the films made about them. If you're interested in learning more, becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? Well, if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted on the show. I discuss films and information that you won't hear on the podcast. Next time, July brings in the next centennial star, character actress Nan Gray, and I'm joined by guest host Samantha Ellis as we look at 1936's Three Smart Girls. Until next time.